You're listening to the Maladjusted Life Podcast, Episode 2. Thanks for listening. Today, my guest is Jessica Pettit.
Woo!
Jessica is a social justice and diversity educator and consultant. I recently read her book, Good Enough Now, how doing the best we can with what we have is better than nothing. And, you know, I generally try to make my my podcast shows thematic. And the theme that her book made me think of in relation to my title, the title of the show, Maladjusted Life, is agency. To what degree are we in control of our lives? So, Jessica, welcome.
Hi.
And again, a Reader's Digest version of your background. Could you tell the audience a little more about yourself and what you do?
Well, sure. Do you want me to talk about how we know each other too?
You can get into that. Yes, go ahead. Go ahead. All right.
Perfect. So I am a diversity and social justice educator. So I do trainings and keynotes all over the country. And professionally, I started working as a college administrator, doing work specifically with subordinated or marginalized communities on college campuses. And then I have kind of gone off on my own to do that on campuses, as well as in organizations, associations, corporate work, etc. I've been doing this for over a decade, and met James actually when I was back at our alma mater. And I've had a really life-changing conversation over disco trays in the cafeteria, really about my own unconscious bias about what attending the same school is like when I feel like I am exactly what our shared undergrad is looking for as an undergraduate student. So I had this blissful, amazing, perfect, like, college dreamy kind of story about what it was like to go back to my undergrad. And as a white, educated, from out of state, liberal arts, lost and wondering and fully funded and fully supported woman, I think that our undergrad was kind of designed for me to explore myself and discover what I wanted to study and do and be in the greater world. And it was an implied aspect of, like, of course I was going to graduate school, but of course I'd go to the Peace Corps first. And years later, when I got to return, I had a conversation with James. We're to talk to you or talk about you while you're here. But while you were still an undergrad, and how significantly different our collection of identities and the intersection of those lived experiences showed up in the same space. And specifically coming from a social justice and diversity place, it was, and continues to be, a really powerful example of how one's work is never done when it comes to conscious and unconscious positive or negative bias. And then, interestingly, I think, is that we've stayed friends, which I think is probably something that both of our lived experiences would make unlikely. And we have hung in there because you're brilliant and make me think about stuff in ways that I really appreciate it. And I like to think I do the same thing for you. And then 3 years ago, I got super burnt out and was about to quit everything. Good thing it was 3 years ago and not now. And really started re-examining my own work and the excuses I was using, excuses other people were using. And then that's why I wrote the book, which is called Good Enough Now. And I'm now back on fire and excited to be doing my work again. And I'm really excited to support you in this new adventure.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
The extended Reader's Digest version.
So your book, Good Enough Now, which was just published, I believe,
July.
In July, okay. Who exactly is the intended audience for this book?
That's a really good question. I think initially writing it was myself, which is a pretty self-absorbed answer. But I think the act of writing it really got me out of my own way and realizing that I'm the best tool I have to continue doing this work. In its kind of manifestation since its publication, it seems to be well-intentioned, underpaid, exhausted, overworked people. And reminding folks, including myself, kind of why are we doing the work that we're doing? Even though it may not actually solve problems, being the right activity actually matters. And even though we're not perfect or rewarded or paid accordingly to the amount of energy and effort we're putting forward, we are the best tool we have. Okay. So, and then maybe people with heartbeats and a checkbook.
There you go. There you go. I mean, the impression I got from reading the book is that it seemed to be more oriented toward people who were, you know, doing social justice work, you know, whether for a nonprofit or in academia. I guess what I would like to know is what could someone who's an everyday Joe working a 9-to-5, what can they take away from a book like this?
Sure. So I think that that's actually my whole approach. You don't have to be a social worker or an activist or get yourself arrested or get yourself not arrested because of your visible identities. You're not going to get challenged in that manner. You can really be anybody. And what if you care about something, and whatever that something is, you need to be responsible for who and how you are when you show up in the work that you care about. And I believe fundamentally being self-aware and taking responsibility for who and how you are allows you to realize that you're at least good. May not be great, but at least you're good. And that there's an opening for other people to also be good. And then that kind of creates some momentum of like the possibility that there is a possibility. When you're burnt out and exhausted, like that little glimmer or flicker of hope is sometimes what it takes to get over feeling underappreciated, not noticing any progress, feeling burnt out, just being exhausted. But it gets you over your own excuses, right? So then it goes to the second piece, which is really about being enough, even though it's not perfect or a measurable solution, but it's enough to try. And if you can try to try, then again, that's that kind of initial starting place of momentum building, which ultimately results in better connections. And by having better connections, you can have conversations that matter. And by having more conversations that matter, all of a sudden you're building community and you're potentially re-engaged in the work.
One thing that stuck out to me when reading the book was that, I mean, obviously you're trying to get people to be okay with who they are at the present moment, but also to, I guess, people to examine their own biases and how they approach others and how they respond to others. I tend to be a very, I don't think this is a secret to anybody who knows me, but I tend to be a very glass half empty kind of guy.
That's why I love you. But I mean, in all honesty, I think that that's one of the things that makes our friendship so important. Yeah. Is that my unicorns and rainbows and the glass is half full of the liquid of choice, but it is full of all kinds of possibilities, right? Like that needs to be yanked down into reality sometimes because it's really disappointing that a unicorn has never shown up to work yet. So thanks.
I mean, I fundamentally know that, you know, I'm in control. I feel like I'm only in control over so much of my life, right? or not just me, anyone, one is only in control over so much in one's life. There are certain things we don't control. We don't control our sex. We don't control our race. We don't control the socioeconomic status we're born into, for example. And those things determine more or less how our life plays out.
Sure.
And I guess it's kind of hard for me to reconcile, you know, all these, you know, kind of determinisms that, you know, you know, determine our fate to some extent. And at the same time, taking responsibility for oneself and being okay with the things that we don't have control over. You know, I have a very hard time reconciling the two. Like, I'm in control of X, Y, and Z, but I can't do anything about A, B, and C, and I have to be okay with that. Do you share that belief? And if you do, how do you deal with that?
I definitely share the belief, and I think the tension or the friction between self-determinism and this stuff we've made up as a culture or as a society as how things have to be is mutable and changeable as well, right? So I feel like most of my work is micro and macro at the same time. And that is part of the reason why it's exhausting, is that you're like, each foot is on a different disc that's floating away from each other. But if you only stand on one, you're not actually, like, if I only do individual work, then I'm not addressing systems work. But if I'm only doing systems work, I'm not taking responsibility for anything I'm actually doing in real life. So I have to do both at the same time. You know, like, I've said this sometimes, speaking about running my own business, being a solopreneur, being a professional speaker, things like that. Mm-hmm. But it's riding two horses at once. And I'm finding this kind of two horses at once showing up more and more and more and more in different kinds of work. But one of them is based on ego, and that I have to be confident. I have to build it, and then they will come. I have to tell people, like, boom, like, this is the place. I am it. The source. Boom, right here. The other horse is of humility, self-doubt, the flip side of ego, right? I mean, like, basic Buddhist principles are holding two conflicting emotions at once. And I think that this pattern is not just an intellectual conversation, but like a lived experience on the ground, regardless of what work you are doing, is that you have the things that you are responsible for and can do something about, and you have the things that are predetermined by other people that you can't necessarily do anything about, their perceptions or their validations coming at you. But at the same time, you are responsible for the ones that you do out to them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I eat ice cream, right? Like, it's exhausting.
I took note of you mentioning the micro and macro levels of the work you do. And I actually highlighted that in your book. And I'm curious to know, why do you think, when it comes to dealing with issues such as racism, which you know is my soapbox, why do you think it's so easy for us to focus on the micro individual stuff as opposed to macro systems level?
Well, I think it goes back, it's a good question. I think it goes back to our individual identities. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, racism is really, work around racism, or as a white person, anti-racism. Mm-hmm. And specifically, I would say, like, blackism, which is a different piece of racism, because it's not just not white people, right? Like, there's a lot of people who are not white and are not perceived to be white.
Right.
But if they're not also perceived as a black man or a black woman, or a black trans person or something like that, like, there's a different reality that happens there, right? So I think that it's easier for others to dismiss, oh, there goes James again. He's an angry black man talking about racism, right? But if I were to do work specifically around homophobia, right? Like, I'm an angry lesbian doing my own agenda, which is why it's imperative that I, as a white person or as a cisgender person, do work around gender equality and anti-racism work from my places of privilege, because my work that I do around my marginalized or subordinated identities, of which I don't have any control of them being subordinated or marginalized, whether they're visible or invisible, gets dismissed by other people. So it's more effective. So then if we partner together, then the work that you do from your dominant identities will actually have far more impact and less cost or risk to you than the work that you do from your subordinated and marginalized identities. That's why it takes a group of people to like really do this work together, and has for decades. Like, this isn't a new idea.
It's not. I think the most significant thing I took away from your book was the head, heart, action model. Mm-hmm. And could you explain that?
Sure. I have to say, like, writing a book is like a super vulnerable thing. So it's like allowing people access to your underwear drawer. Then someone you really respect says they read your book, which is like, by the way, I looked in your underwear drawer. So it's like, So now someone I really respect and think is really brilliant is asking me to talk about the model I just made up. Hopefully it made sense to outside of my brain. But the concept is, when I started noticing, when I started debunking bad things about bad diversity trainings that weren't working, it started at judgments and assumptions. So bad diversity training says you're never, ever, 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 ever supposed to make a judgment and assumption. And the reality is that we do all the time so that we can feel safe and prepared, right? Mm-hmm. So I was really looking at, like, if it's not about not doing it, then maybe it's about being responsible for doing it. So what informs our judgments and assumptions? I started paying attention, and I believe, and this is heavily premised in my book, but our lived experience has taught us individually how to show up most of the time so that we can feel relatively safer or slightly more prepared, maybe a little bit more familiar. Then if we're self-aware enough, then we can be responsible to recognize the original story that we wrote might not be accurate. But what I wanted to do was to see what patterns exist in the story writing in the first place. And I believe our lived experiences teach us how to either really focus on details, so that's the heady piece,
right?
How to really focus on ideas, which is the hearty piece. So sometimes people think hearty is the emotion piece, but emotional responses are actually heady. But hearty responses are like bigger ideas, bigger connections versus like one tiny incident. And some people really respond from an action-oriented place of just doing things. They don't want to sit around and talk about it and contemplate. They need to do something. There's a sense of safety or preparation that I think in most of us that either results in us leaning very strongly in one of those directions, or more likely a combination of two of the directions. So then the model of head, heart, action then has three archetypes. So there's the head action folks, the heart action folks, and the head, heart action folks. So the archetypes leave the third variable dangling. And the reason why this is so important is I call it the third rail.
Right.
Like on a subway system, the third rail is the thing you don't touch because it'll electrocute you, but it also powers the entire system. So what I have uncovered, and I believe, is that like the veneer or the facade that we show up is one or two of the variables of, look at me, look how safe and prepared I am. This is how I'm going to make all my judgments and assumptions. This is how I'm going to interact and respond and all my habits and all that kind of stuff. But like a shadow, our third place is what all of our excuses come from. All of the times that, like, so mine is heart, when I feel like a fraud, when I'm like, what on earth are people hiring me to do this for? I'm an idiot. I can barely tie my own shoes. I lock myself out of my hotel room all the time. What am I doing? Like, that's how I'm using my third rail to, like, stop me or to enable me to believe that I can't do something. Then when I look back over things in my life, or crucible moments, as I call them, where I was able to do things and I have no idea how I was able to do them, or I really, like, lost track of time because I was so in the flow and so in love with everything I was doing, it was when that third shadow piece came forward and I was using all three of them. So, like, when I read, there's four books, Difficult, Fierce, Crucial, and Courageous Conversations. They all focus very much on this kind of A, B communication conversation. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really feel like they paid attention to this floating piece. And it's the floating piece that is those two horses again, right? It's all my insecurities and this, like, hidden source of confidence. And so what I tried to do in the book was, if you can identify the two that you show up with, like, as a scrim, so you can do work around the one piece, then you can be responsible for the negative aspects of that one piece that's back here, or you can actually, like, utilize it as a tool to, like, gas pedal you through mm-hmm. something that's really hard.
Okay. Okay. I just found that trifurcation, really interesting, and I was trying to apply it to myself.
Mm. How did you diagnose yourself?
I'm definitely a head person for sure. Mm-hmm. For sure.
Okay. I've met.
I would say a head, and I guess maybe secondary would be heart. Not so much an action person.
But in action, I agree with you, by the way. That is how I would diagnose you, too. Yeah. Mm. But your inaction or your paralysis mm-hmm. or your it don't matter what I do, it's not going to work, like, that stuff mm-hmm. is your action piece. Until you get, like, enfuegoed and excited or passionate or angry, and then you launch into a different kind of action. That's still that third variable. So it's always present. It's just using it in this way or using it in this way. And then my premise is that, can we actually harness with some intention how we use our third variable some of the time, occasionally, to do good in the world?
Right. Okay.
Doing the best we can with what we got some of the time.
Some of the time. I was thinking about what you said earlier about people choosing to show up in a presenting an aspect of themselves to be safe, mm-hmm. show up in a safe way. It made me think of the concept of stereotyping, right? Mm-hmm. And stereotypes, you know, function as a mental shorthand for us to perhaps understand a large, scary world and the things in it that may just be too overwhelming for us to understand. Mm-hmm. So we just make a short list in our heads of what to expect, mm-hmm. whether it be people, whatever. Mm-hmm. Did you ever see a connection between the way people choose to show up at a particular in a particular relationship and the idea of stereotyping? I'm not sure if I'm explaining myself well, but I feel like there's a connection between people stereotyping. Mm-hmm. Because you stereotype in order to understand the world to be safe, right? To prevent, you know, potential harm to oneself. right? You're making the world easier for you to understand.
Yep.
You're being prepared. And I'm just kind of wondering, do you often, do you ever make the connection between the two, people choosing to be safe in certain and environments by showing up in a particular way, and perhaps how they, these same people may choose to form certain ideas or concepts about the institutions or people they interact with?
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, so let me, four things have come to mind. Mm-hmm. So stereotyping, internalized and externalized mm-hmm. stereotypes, and then shifting and covering, right? So first off with stereotyping, so you focused on like me stereotyping other people, working with those stereotypical labels so that I can show up safe and prepared, right?
Exactly. So
that's how I engage, is with these like sunglasses on that I have learned, and I've either learned them in school, I've learned them consciously or unconsciously, my lived experience has taught me, whatever. That is now how I walk through the world, right? Like I have these stereotypes to work with. The flip of this is that in order for me to feel like I belong, I have to align with the stereotype, right? So like if I decide that I want to be a really good mother, I do not have children, you're welcome, but let's say I decide I want to be a very good mother. What is the stereotype I hold of what it means to be a very good mother? It could be my own mother. It could be the exact opposite of my own mother. And depending on my neighborhood that I live in, my neighborhood is going to tell me what a good mother is, because I will already be aware of who the bad mother is, right? So then I'm going to lean into the stereotype so that I can belong to the story that someone else has written about what a good mother is.
Okay.
So I become the stereotype, which then validates the people who wrote the story about that stereotype in the first place, because look, see, that's what it looks like. So that's an evil loop, right? Is I want to belong and I want to feel safe and prepared. And I want to belong and I want to be safe and prepared. So then individually, what also ends up happening that impacts relationships is based on stereotypes, wanting to feel safe, wanting to feel prepared, self-preservation, etc., how one shifts or covers their lived experience or their identities depends on the assumptions that I'm making about the people or the situation I'm about to interact with. So I may code some of my language differently or shift the information I disclose or how I talk about my life or what language I use so that it fits how I'm stereotyping the very people that I'm working with.
We call that code switching, folks.
Right. That's code switching. That's what it is. Right. So code switching, shifting, covering. The shifting and covering are two books by those titles that I probably read them first 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And those two books started my brain that I think led to my own book, right? So Shifting is a book that is, I think there's 12 women, specifically Black women, that are highlighted in the book, but it was a study of interviewing Black women in different contexts, whether at work, family, dating, personal life, professional life, etc. And it illuminates these very specific roles that Black women are allowed to play in our society. And one woman can actually shift between those roles based on what they think is going to make them feel most safe and prepared. And how they shift depends on who else they're with, how they're standing with other people, authority-wise, or even physical space. So fascinating how the relationship is between how an individual manifests themselves in relationship to how other people are stereotyping them in the first place, right? Like, whoa. That was a great book. And then Covering, mm-hmm. It's talking about it. Covering being the new fight in civil rights. And that will we ever be able to live in a space together where we do not have to hide or cover ideas, opinions, identities, lived experiences, etc., so that if I do share these things, it won't shift a narrative of stereotype. So what do I reveal and what do I keep close to the chest because I'm scared of what will happen when it reveals? It's a fabulous book. I highly recommend it.
Covering, who's that by the way?
Kenji Yoshino. Yoshino.
Okay, I'll have to look that up.
It's such a good book. You're going to love it.
Okay. And was there a fourth entity or?
Oh, so the stereotype is internalized, externalized, and then shifting and covering.
Okay. Okay, that was all. And going back to your, I guess your tripartite model, the head, action, and heart. And just kind of connecting that to what you just talked about, I guess showing up as a stereotype to, I guess, somewhat, you know, to feel accepted or
to belong
or understood. Personal thing. I had an incident, here in Little Rock recently at a local restaurant. I was out with a friend, and she was snapping photos of me for her portfolio. And we decided to go eat at this restaurant after she, you know, was done with the photos. And, you know, we're drinking, we're eating, drinking alcohol, of course. And we're about done, and a security guard comes outside, and I notice he keeps staring at me, and he asked me for my ID. And I'm curious as to why he's asking for my ID. I mean, I know he's not asking, you know, if I'm underage, because, you know, he sees the bottles of beer on the table. And obviously in order to get that, the waiter would have had to have checked my ID. So I know that's not why he's asking for it. And I just asked him, what do you need to see my ID for? He said, just let me see it. And I didn't want any trouble, so I just gave him my ID. And he just looked at me, looked the ID, looked at me, and then gave it back to me. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm here, and I'm here with my friend. He's going to ask her for her ID as well. Friend, white girl, by the way. He does not ask her for her ID. And mind you, she and I are the most, I guess you say, quote unquote, normal looking people out there on the deck on this night. I mean, you have cats back there smoking weed, women walking around damn near half naked, and he decides to ask me for my ID. Now, the reason why I'm connecting this to the head, heart, and action model is because I'm thinking how I responded to it. So in my head, I'm thinking, why the hell is he asking me for my ID? And then this is not without getting emotional about it. I'm just like, why is he asking me for my ID? I don't understand me specifically. And I guess the heart aspect is thinking, having that one experience of, having that one experience remind me of previous similar experiences. Like everything's coming together in that one moment. And then in terms of action, and this is the part that relates to stereotypes, do I, you know, what do I do? Do I just smile and keep it moving? Do I get angry and be the angry black dude that I'm pretty sure he expects me to be? And that night I just cooperated. I didn't smile about it, but I cooperated. I went as far as just that. Like I said, I asked him, why do you want to see my ID? It didn't make any sense to me, but I was beyond frustrated. I couldn't even get angry. You know, you just, when the when something's happened to you, it's like you can't really get angry about it because you've experienced it so much. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of just fatigue.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Fatigue is the best word for it.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't really get angry until after the fact,
mm-hmm.
like days after the fact. It's like, wow, this actually happened again. Right.
Mm-hmm. I think that the piece that's important, mm-hmm. if we're using the model, right?
Right.
So the head piece is, what are my rights here?
Mm-hmm.
Is he likely to ask my white woman friend for their ID? No. Is he likely to ask for those pot smokers on the deck for their ID? No. Do I have the right to say no? Do I have the right to comply? Like, that's the heady piece, right?
Mm-hmm.
The hearty piece is, are you kidding me? Like, you're going to stroll up here on this deck and single me out because this is how systematic racism works. Of course you're going to do this. Of course. Now, another heady person maybe would say, well, you don't know that he didn't check other people's IDs. You don't know what's going on in Little Rock. You don't know. Maybe there was a complaint about a really good looking black man with beautiful dreads, like just did something terrible. And so now like, oh, look, here's a beautiful black man with locks. Like, must be that. Like, you don't know. Like, that's a heady response, right? Is perfectly logical explanations. The hearty response is, yeah, you live in a racist country. Like, what are you expecting? Like, duh, right? That's the heart response. The other heart response is your pileup and your space and right to be angry about something that is horrifically unfair and unjust can also be dismissed as, James, don't feed into racism. Don't be part of the problem. Like, you just need to comply and like just keep it moving, right? Like, that is also a heart response. When in this particular case, there is a high likelihood that if that went wrong, it could go way wrong. Not like mildly wrong. The statistical likelihood of way wrong happening is a reality. I'm not even going to get my ID checked. But you have to constantly weigh that, like, there is a very good chance that this incredibly unjust, unfair, illegal search of my identity that is going to be occurring on the deck while people are doing illegal things could result in my death, my imprisonment, whatever. Like, that is a real thing in the country that we live in. Mm-hmm. So because you're constantly having to live and weigh that out, how is that not fatigue? Of course that's fatigue, right? Absolutely, that's fatigue. So the action responses to that are incredibly limited for you because they could result in your death. That takes a lot of things off the list.
And hence me coming back to the theme of agency, right? So,
right.
And having, you know, experienced that, I thought, like, you know, at the time, just being in the moment, I thought, you know, what can I actually do but refuse to give him my ID and just leave and not frequent the place anymore. Don't come back. And even that, and in doing that, I think that would have been, you know, the best thing to do. But even that, I feel like that really doesn't do anything. It just, you know, it makes me feel better that, you know, it would make me feel better that I'm not going to a place that, you know, discriminated against me. But in the broader sense of things, you know, I don't feel like it would have really accomplished anything.
No, but you know what does? Talking about it, sharing it with other people who don't experience those things, somehow allowing yet again your completely unfair treatment to be an educational moment for people who don't experience that, which is also fatigue making, right? But like bringing it up on this podcast is actually an action-oriented response. Because it took away your agency in the moment, and just leaving the restaurant, like, you could get marked as, like, some annoying guy, right? Like, there's no way to know that they're not going to remember what you look like or figure out what car you're in or get your plates or whatever. Like, that doesn't mean it's the end of the story.
Right.
And you removing your agency doesn't mean that you've removed their agency to continue being unfair and unjust. So you did what you did to stay alive, and you should be able to have a beer wherever you want to. You're a grown adult, right? That's not the world we live in. So then you took your agency now, and you're bringing this up, not in a complaining way, mm-hmm. not in a way that can easily be dismissed by other people and their stereotypes and their responses, but you're using your agency to say, here is another example of thousands that I experience, whether it's fatigue or PTSD or just anger, etc. And we're going to talk about this and how this has to do with my human agency, because you have human agency. So you started this podcast to talk about these exact issues. Mm-hmm. Like, welcome to your trifecta.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
There's one aspect of this story too that is probably the most troubling, and that's actually seeing white witnesses to what was going on to me, and just like them just, you know, sitting there and just observing, not really saying anything.
Mm-hmm.
I know, because I mean, me existing how I exist in the world as a black man, I take this stuff really as a matter of course. It's just like, I know it's going to happen at, you know, statistically speaking somewhere. But to have, you know, be surrounded by a group of, and I'm going to resort to a stereotype, but to be surrounded by a group of young white hipsters, essentially, mm-hmm. you know, and these kids are, I'm calling them kids, or they were younger than me. And, you know, for this generation to be so supposedly so accepting and so, I don't know, against injustice. I mean, it was a bit unnerving seeing them just sitting there and observing, the whole situation go down. And then, you know, when the security guard leaves my table after having checked my ID, you know, then people saying, oh, that was really shitty what he did to you. And my entire time I'm thinking, why didn't you say anything then? I mean, he's probably, I feel like, you know, that coming from you is going to be a lot more meaningful than a statement like that coming from me.
Yep. Which goes back to like us doing work from our dominant identities, right? And you also have to remember, they also have their own stereotypes and also have their own inexperience of what to or not to do.
Mm-hmm.
If they're paying attention, this is mm-hmm. a heavy response, right? And coming up to you and being like, dude, that was really jacked up. Like, maybe there's a level, right? So like, if things got escalated from ID, then maybe they'd be doing something. But white people specifically, we don't get asked for our IDs. I can drive anywhere on this planet without an ID and not even get a ticket, because I'll just talk my way out of it. I talked my way into Canada and out of Canada because I forgot my passport.
Wow.
Right? So like, whoa, what's going on? Like, it is an unfamiliar act to even be asked for an ID. I'm not making an excuse. And how would you know that?
Yeah, true.
That's why we have to talk about these things.
And I think, like, you know, situations like that, and this is just me, and we've talked about this a little bit in the past, but situations like that make me very skeptical of white allyship with black folks. And I don't know. I feel like some people who say that they're allies. I don't know. I think they do it for, and not to say that this is an illegitimate reason for doing it, but it shouldn't be the only reason. I feel like some of them are doing it, you know, to, out of some sense of guilt.
Sure.
I don't think some of them have a real sincere desire to see another group of people necessarily do better or prevent them from being treated in a certain way. It's just like they have this profound sense of guilt, and it's like, I'm, you know, going to support cause X, Y, and Z by these people superficially.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that keeps me out of harm's way, though.
Yeah, or like, I'm happy to help you as long as it doesn't hurt me in some way.
Right.
Right, so it's self-preservation assistance. Like, that's not actually how anything's going to change. One of the best things that I think has come out of, and I can't even believe I'm saying these sentences, so like, I recognize that itself is jacked up, but one of the best things that I think has come out of white people's higher awareness of police and specifically black men and reactions and that resulting in people, unarmed men being killed. There is a heightened awareness as if this is some new thing, right? But it is a new awareness. I don't think it's a new thing, but it is a new awareness. But what I've noticed is this white guilt. I believe prior to kind of Mike Brown, Ferguson, and the beginning of those kind of pieces that led to Black Lives Matter and things like this, that what I heard white people often say was, I didn't own slaves, but I need to do something good, right? Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, I'm not part of the problem. But it went back to slavery as if slavery was 7,000 years ago, or as if people are not currently also still enslaved, or there are people alive who actually were enslaved, right? Like, there's a story somehow that this is so long ago. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, you don't really actually probably even know if your family owned or didn't own slaves. But the narrative was, I personally do not currently own slaves, therefore I am not racist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Similarly with the KKK, I have never burned a cross in my yard, therefore I am not racist. And what I have seen come out of the Black Lives Matter movement and the unfortunate death of too many men for me to even keep track of, and women, is the timeline has shifted. So it has gone from this like metaphorical, like, you know, caveman period when slavery happened a long time ago that I personally have never anticipated or worked with, or these crosses that happened like 100,000 years ago, which is also not true and still happening today. But it has shifted to, did you know that racism is happening today? And like, as pathetic as that is a really big shift in the conversation. Mm-hmm. And that the timeline has come so forward into right now. So even if people think that it's some one-off and it's not a pattern of racism or systemic oppression, specifically from a police state, they at least are using a timeline that's current and in their current consciousness.
Right.
Which is an important shift.
Yeah, it's an improvement for sure.
Pathetic.
Right. I think one shift, one thing I've noticed in these recent slew of killings of black men by the police over the past, 4 or 5 years, is I've noticed, you know, on social media, because of so many problems nowadays, but I've noticed on social media that a lot of young white people, when I say a lot of young white people get enraged about these things, for some reason they feel the need to tell their non-white friends and acquaintances about how shocked they are and they can't believe this is going on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe they need to hear that. I don't know. But
well, I think a distance, I think that there's a feeling of distancing themselves, including myself. I'm sure I do this mm-hmm. too. from responsibility,
mm-hmm.
right? Is that like, if I can somehow absolve myself from being part of this group membership by individually telling you how shocked and awed and hurt and angry I am. But group membership still happens. This can be true, but group membership still happens.
But not only that, they tell their shock and awe, but they also, I think some of these folks like to tell about how they want to work with, you know, for certain causes for people of color, which is cool. But I guess the conflict for me is just like in my philosophy. And I feel like for young white folks, you know, nothing about racism and white supremacy is going to change unless white people are talking to other white people.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost kind of, I just feel like they have to always be engaged with people of color to make things happen. And I think mm-hmm. that's an aspect of that, but I feel like they ignore another aspect. With talking to their own.
It goes back to individual versus group, right? Like I'm a cool individual because I have this collection of diversity in my life.
Right.
But I'm not going to take responsibility for my group level membership.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well.
On that uplifting note.
Well, thank you for.
Can I add something just so that it adds, it at least ends with, in case some white folk somewhere is actually trying to figure out like what to do about racism.
Mm-hmm.
So. Specifically, dear white women who might be listening to this, number one, you do not need an invitation for an organized gathering that comes with a theme and a matching t-shirt and a certificate of completion in order to have a conversation with another white person about racism. You could actually just bring it up. Like when you are with your friends at Starbucks and your lattes have all arrived and you're sharing the biscotti of the flavor of the month, sit down and actually talk about like, how does whiteness show up in our lives? What do we do as white people? When your friends are like, Laura, we're trying to have a good brunch here. Just ask anyway and do it again. Right? Right, Becky? Like, right, Amy? You can do this. Like, just have a conversation with other white people about whiteness. Just do it. Just for funsies. Right? It's a really great way to get rid of the people that you don't want to talk to. And the ones you don't want to talk to will stick around. But I think that this is part of being good enough, too, is that I think that most of us, specifically white women, do not feel qualified to start a conversation. So we are awaiting to be invited to a conversation. So if that's the case, invite somebody to a probably shitty, not well done, not well organized, organic, real person conversation, because there are people lying in wait, waiting for someone to take some initiative to have the conversation. And nothing is going to change until those organic conversations start happening.
I agree. And I also agree that it's nice to thin out the so-called friends.
Right. Who wants Tiffany to come anyway? Great. Oh, it's too deep for you. Bye.
Well, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for still being my friend.
Of course. Jessica's book is Good Enough Now. How Doing the Best We Can with What We Have is Better Than Nothing. And I'm pretty sure you can find it on Amazon. Like you can find just about anything nowadays. Thank you, Jessica.
You are more than welcome. Thank you for taking action and putting this podcast together.
All right. Bye.
Bye.